Too many businesses are losing money on their second highest fixed expense. And it doesn't have to be this way. At Riata Commercial Realty, we only represent occupiers, so we are 100% on your side as we negotiate for your commercial space, whether for lease or purchase. Landlords have representation, do you? And I'm asking you again, Bob.
Yes.
In today's topic is exciting to me because this is to me where a tenant rep really shows their mettle and their worth. We're going to talk about how fast buildings are selling and at the increased prices they are selling for. Stay tuned on Confessions of a Recovering Landlord podcast. Okay, my teaser was showing our worth. Talk to us about today's environment, specifically here at Riata. We're actually seeing the Riata.
Yeah, I was going to say.
It's a close cousin to Riata. This topic is, well, we're seeing it firsthand.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the property type we're talking about, though. So I imagine the thing that you're mainly focused on here is industrial. Because industrial buildings are definitely increasing in value rapidly. Rental rates are going up rapidly. We're seeing rental rates coming back on proposals from landlords for buildings or for clients that have been in a industrial lease for 5 years. We're seeing increases in rental rates of 40 to 70% on those. And so when rental rates go up, the value of the buildings go up. And so, yeah, if you're wanting to buy an industrial building right now, or even a flex building, it's a lot more expensive than it was a few years ago.
So in a non-disclosure state, which tell us what that means.
Well, in the state of Texas, the way property taxes are determined is there's two components. The first component is what's the value of the property. And the second component is what's called the mill rate, or the tax rate established by the taxing entities. So the first piece of that is the valuation. So the valuation is determined by appraisal districts. Way back, it used to be that you had, you know, the county and the city and the school district and the hospital district, all these entities that tax property would establish their own value for the buildings. So you could end up paying, based on a $1 million valuation to the city, but a $1.5 million valuation from the school district and a, you know, $1.2 million for the county or something. I mean, it was all over the board. So the state said, hey, you know what, let's get some consistency here. So they created the appraisal districts. So every county in the state of Texas, and I think we have 256 counties, each one of those has their own appraisal district, and it's a governmental entity that looks at every single piece of property and says, this is the value of that property. They do this for houses, for office buildings, for hotels, every single piece of property, they establish value. And they also manage the exemptions. So if you have a homestead for your primary home, then you get a homestead exemption. If you're over a certain age, you have an over 65 exemption. You don't typically have exemptions in commercial property, but agricultural property has an exemption. So agricultural properties, I think their valuations are only like 10% of what the true value of that property is. And it's basically like a subsidy to help farmers continue farming the land, because if they had to pay taxes on the true value of the property, they probably couldn't make any money farming it. So the appraisal districts were created to establish those values. Then you have each of those other entities I mentioned, school district, county, city, et cetera. Each of them establish their tax rates based on their budgets. So if a city needs, you know, $500 million to operate, they figure out what's the tax base within their city limits, and they change the tax rate to get to the $500 million that they need to operate their city.
So can I run my budget that way? I really like that concept.
I need 500
million.
How much
money I need to live the way I want. And then I just have all my minions go out and give it to me.
Yes, but they are us. We are the city. I know.
That's why this topic is getting scary. Continue.
Exactly. So that's the appraisal district system. That's how you establish the values.
Okay.
So the real issue here is, how are the values really determined?
Right. Since it's a non-disclosure state.
Yeah. So
where are they getting that basis?
I'm going way around the mulberry bush here to answer your question.
Well, you're creating a platform.
Sorry about that. Context.
That's all right.
So let's look at it from a residential standpoint, first of all. So in the residential real estate world in Texas, the actual assessed value, and I'm going to make that distinction. Assessed value is the value for assessing taxes.
Taxation.
That's
yeah.
not the same
not
thing.
Market as value.
I'm going to actually give you three different values here. One's the assessed value established by the appraisal district. One is the market value, meaning what is the true value that a buyer and seller can agree to sell slash purchase the building for. And then there's the appraised value.
Okay. Can I add a fourth?
Yes, you can.
Insurable value.
And there's a fifth. The lender value. I mean, so there's a lot of different values. And you know what? Any individual property has a different value for every single prospective buyer. So I'm going to look at the building and say, well, this is the way I'm going to look at the building. Therefore, I think it's worth $1 million. You're going to look at it and say, well, I'm going to do this in the building and I can spend $1.2 million and still accomplish my goals and objectives.
Okay, real quick, give a concrete example. I'm going to buy a building as an investor. I'm going to buy a building as an owner occupier.
Absolutely. So an investor, we had a building for sale several years ago where a client of ours no longer needed the building that they occupied. So we had a listing. You know, we don't often have listings since we're a corporate advisory firm, but whenever our clients no longer need the space that they occupy, they have excess property, then we have to help them sell it or sublease it. So this client was wanted to sell their building. We thought it was probably worth around $7.5 million to a owner occupant, because their analysis is how much does it cost to buy it versus how much does it cost to lease it. So it's a very simplistic math computation to kind of figure that out. Investors were coming to us, however, and offering us 6.3, 6.5, basically $1 million less than what an owner-occupier was offering us. Well, part of the reason for that was because an investor has to take into account, hey, how long is it going to take me to find a tenant? And so I'm going to have to continue paying my mortgage until I find that tenant. So if it takes me 6 months or a year to find that tenant, they got to figure, you know, build that into their model.
Back into that, yeah.
How much is it going to cost them to provide improvements for that tenant? Commissions to the tenant rep broker and to the in-house broker. Once that tenant moves out, how long is it going to be vacant before they get it relet? So they have to kind of build a very complex model in trying to figure out how this building is going to actually make them money. And plus, an owner-occupier can get a loan with only 10 to 15% down, whereas an investor is going to have to put down 25 to 30%. So they have a much bigger equity infusion potentially. So all that has to be taken into account. So usually an investor is going to pay less than an owner occupant. The exception to that is going to be if it's an already leased building on a long-term triple net lease. And in that case, you can sell it more on a cap rate basis. And that, in all likelihood, that would probably be the highest value of all as far as buyers go.
Okay. So still back to the non-disclosure.
Yes. So in the state, got to stop asking me questions. So back to the residential. In residential, all residential agents that I know of use the multiple listing service through the local association of realtors. One of the requirements within that platform is that whenever they sell a property, they have to actually disclose to the system what they sold the property for or bought it for. So it has to be disclosed how much it was sold for. Well, guess who subscribes to the multiple listing service? The appraisal district. So the appraisal district has virtually real-time data at all times on actual house prices. In commercial, on the other hand, that's not the case. The commercial primary database that most people use is called CoStar. And then there's some others. Crexie is another one. There's a few others, commercial source. But the one that's most used by commercial real estate brokers is CoStar. Well, nowhere in CoStar or Crexie or commercial source or any of the rest of them is there a requirement for disclosure within that. Now, the state itself has laws that says if you buy or sell a property, you don't have to tell anybody what you paid for it or what you sold it for. So that's the truth for both residential and commercial. So those laws are the same. It's the platforms that are used by the brokers, the agents, that then gives the appraisal districts the ability to see what's really happening or not. Now, so how does the appraisal district find out what a commercial property is really valued at? Well, there's two ways. One, if somebody discloses it, they'll find out. Few people do that. Another way they find out is if the property that is sold has a mortgage on it, the mortgage company is going to file their lien. They're going to perfect their lien by recording that lien at the county courthouse. So if the appraisal district sees, oh, there's an $800,000 mortgage on this piece of property that just sold, they're going to say, well, they probably put 20% down, maybe 30% down. So let's say it's probably really sold for $1 million, $1.1 million. So they're going to establish a value of that $1 million in that situation. If they don't have the mortgage number, they're kind of shooting in the dark.
The way this gets trued up is in a down market. Because if I go and a building is currently being taxed at $1.2 million and I get it for $800,000, I'm at the courthouse steps going, looky, looky, here's what I bought it for. Decrease my tax base. So
yeah, and you're going to show them your closing statement to prove that up.
But
and
that, of course, is not happening in this market.
Oh, heck no. But you're right. I mean, if they've overvalued it, you're quick to pull out your closing statement. If they've undervalued it, they won't. So whenever you got a building sale occur, and like right now we have a building that I was looking at, which is on the tax records for $1 million, but the asking price is three and a half. So a buyer now has to think, all right, if I buy this building and I pay $3 million, are my taxes going to triple? And the answer is maybe, probably not. It depends on how you finance it. If you go out there and get an 80% mortgage that gets filed, then yeah, it's probably going to go up. Is it going to go up all the way to $3 million? Maybe not all in 1 year. It may become, that may happen over a few years. But you don't really know for sure. If you pay cash for it, then you don't really know. Bottom line is, if you have a commercial property and you have the opportunity to, you know, if the appraisal district, I should say, increases the value above what you think is reasonable, you hire a property tax consulting firm to go in and argue it for you. And even if you did pay more, you might still be able to get the price down because you could argue deferred maintenance, or I'm not getting the rental rate that I thought.
Or I have to put into it to bring it up to code.
Yeah, so there's a lot of things like that. So you're going to want to hire a property tax consultant to try and reduce that price almost every year. And you know what? If the appraisal district doesn't give you the price you want, then you appeal it. If that doesn't work, then you can always hire a law firm and sue the appraisal district. Mm-hmm. I've done that dozens and dozens and dozens of times.
When you were on the dark side, I was on the landlord side.
Yeah. So, yeah, you can definitely do that. You know, is that always going to be successful and get you to the bottom line number you want? Maybe not, but it was always successful in terms of the reduced taxes we got was always more than the cost of the lawsuit.
Well, especially if you can get you're in bed with that law firm and you can get them to take it on a contingency basis. I mean, that's what tax consultants do. You don't pay them unless they save you something, and then they usually take half.
Yeah, and on the law firms, you know, it varies. Some of them charge flat fees. Some of them might do it on a contingency basis or some combination of that.
Yeah. So now to the crux of today's podcast. Someone buys a building in which we have a tenant or two. And the price is much greater than when we put the tenant in there. Those pass-through costs, i.e. taxes, are going to affect the operating expenses of what that tenant then pays in the years going forward.
Right.
How do we protect our clientele?
Well, that's a tricky question because there's two ways that property taxes typically get passed through to the tenants. You have a lease structure, which is called a triple net lease structure, where you have a base rent, you have the operating expenses, and then you have electricity.
Taxes and insurance.
Well, no, electricity. So taxes and insurance are usually included in the what I would call the operating expenses, the middle. Although you're right, a lot of times landlords will split that up into a common area of maintenance and then a taxes and then an insurance. So they kind of try to create multiple buckets. Bottom line, in a triple net lease structure, the reality is that they just pass through those expenses to the tenants. It's not a profit center for the landlord. They're just passing through whatever the costs are of running the building. In the case of taxes, they're not going to allow you to put a limitation on any increases in that. So there are certain expenses that are considered controllable by the landlord and things that are considered non-controllable by the landlord. Property taxes, insurance, utilities, snow removal are sort of the generally agreed non-controllables. And occasionally the landlords will try to throw in a few other things. So we will argue about those other things. But generally, I don't know a single landlord that will put a cap on property taxes. So once a tenant's in there subject to a lease, there's no way to protect them from that on sale. Now, you could put language in the lease that says if there are increases in the tax value due to the, you know, that are a direct result of a change in ownership. And I mean, you could try that. I would bet you you're not going to be able to get that actually into a lease, you know, more than 1 in 100 times.
Okay. Well, I happen to know personally that you have done this.
Well, now that's,
so tell us how.
You're getting ahead of us. That's a different situation. Cause I, you know, my point was once they're in there as a lease, you know, as a tenant.
Well, you were talking about when you were negotiating the lease though, too.
So the other lease structure I was going to mention is what we call the full service plus electric. So now you have the base rent, which includes the operating expenses and then the electricity. In that structure, you are given what's called a base year for operating expenses. And so all that means is whatever the expenses were in the base year, let's say that's, you know, a lease signed in 2022, your base year is going to be $10 a square foot. So if your base rent is $30 a square foot, but your expenses in 2022 are $10, that's your base year. Well, in the future years, if the operating expenses increase above that $10, then the tenant pays their piece of that. So if in 2023 they go to $10.50, the tenant's still paying their $30 base rent, but they're also paying that extra 50 cents a square foot, which is the increase in property tax. In the overall expenses. Property taxes are a component of that, right? And you still have the same issue of controllable, non-controllable, if you've set up the lease that way. Let's say you have a 5 or 6 or 7% cap on controllable expenses. Well, yeah, those are going to be limited, but the uncontrollable stuff like property taxes are not going to be limited. So the full amount of the increase can be passed through to the tenant. So back now to your question of how do we deal with that in another case. So we had a situation where two clients leased in a building that had been foreclosed and was fully vacant. And so in the first tenant we negotiated in that, we knew that the assessed value for property taxes was way low and much lower than the true market value of that building. So it was going to be a base year building. So it was really important to establish what the expenses were going to be in that base year. Well, we knew the taxes were going to be way undervalued because the appraisal district hadn't caught up to the fact that it had been purchased and is now having tenants in it. So what we did is we said, all right, we'll agree to the base year for other operating expenses, but for property taxes, which is going to be the big daddy cost, we want a base year 3 years from now. So we have one base year for all the other expenses, and then we have a base year of a few years later for property taxes. Landlord didn't like that idea. They wanted something concrete in the lease. So what we ended up doing is we ended up saying, all right, you own a bunch of other buildings in the area. So let's go look at buildings that you've owned for 3 years or more of the same type of building with the same rental rates and see what those are valued at. And so we figured that out. And so instead of a base year, we had an expense stop for property taxes. So in that particular case, I think it was $1.25 a square foot. So we said, basically, you know, until the property taxes exceed $1.25 a square foot, the tenant isn't responsible for paying any part of that property tax. And we did those deals, I want to say, in 2018. Mm-hmm. And thus far, the tenant has not had to pay anything above the property, above the $1.25 expense stop, because taxes haven't gotten above that. You know, that will likely change in the coming years. Although we did one of those deals on a 5-year deal. And I'm pretty confident that we will never exceed that threshold. The other one did a 7-year deal. So there's a chance that might. So that's certainly one way you can do it. But again, you got to do that up front when you sign the lease. You can't expect to be protected on something that you didn't have the foresight to deal with at the beginning.
Well, I like it when people say you make your money in real estate when you buy the property, not when you sell it. And in this case, you make the good deal when you negotiate the lease, not afterwards. You've got to get all this in writing. That's why I think it's just so crucial that you have an experienced tenant rep repping you on these kind of things, because that could have been a huge expense that occurred. They wouldn't have thought about. And of course, the landlord's not raising the issue.
Well, I think if I'm remembering correctly, the value of that building on the tax rolls was like $500,000 or $560,000.
And it recently sold. Do you happen to know what it sold for? Any idea?
It's a non-disclosure state.
Right.
And it was also sold as part of a portfolio. This particular landlord sold their entire portfolio, and they had a lot of buildings. So I don't know what the value assigned to that one building was. But suffice it to say, when you have a 75,000 square foot building that's on the tax rolls for $560,000, I mean, on a price per square foot basis, it's nothing. I mean, the rents were more than that. So, you know, there was a huge, huge increase potential as soon as the appraisal district started noticing that the building was being leased. Well, how does the appraisal district know it's being leased? Well, they see the tax, county courthouse records for when it sells. But you know what? They also get information from the city. So every time you pull a permit to do construction in the building and you've established a value for that construction contract, well, they see that too. So, you know, you have a building valued at $560,000, but they see that you've done building permits for interior construction for another $1 million, let's say. Well, now they say, well, it's at least worth $1.5 million, right? But then you take a look at what the value is as a result of those rents, and that actually could end up being a much higher value than just the cost of the construction.
Yeah. This convo could go on a lot longer, but we'll cut it off here. I just think it's good information, but in this environment, it's crucial information, because buildings are changing hands rapidly and the prices are egregious. And this is just one of those points you need to be educated on.
Hey, before we stop real quick, though, I do want to mention one thing. What about when prices go down? And I know that's not really what we think we're seeing right now, certainly not in industrial, but in office, there is the potential for some of those things to be happening, as there's not as much occupancy in office buildings as people work from home, work virtually, et cetera. There is the real possibility that some buildings could actually have a reduction in the value. So you got to be careful again when you write the leases. If it's a base year lease, tenants never get a benefit when the expenses go below the base year amount. So if your base rent is $30 a square foot and the $10 a square foot is your base year expense number, if those fall down to to $9.75 or to $8, the tenant, it's not like the $30 base rent goes down to $28.
Right.
So they never get the benefit of that. In a triple net lease situation, however, the tenants are supposed to pay whatever the expenses actually are. So if the operating expenses actually fall, then they should get that benefit. However, I have seen a lease, a triple net lease, where the landlord said the expenses won't ever be below what they were in the year in which the lease was signed. And I'm like, oh, heck no. You know, I'm lining that thing out in a hurry. And, you know, that's the, you know, I want my cake and eat it too provision for the landlord. So again, you got to read the fine print, and these leases are long, and, mm-hmm. you know, but there's no substitute for that. And the attorney is not necessarily going to catch that, because, I mean, the attorney's there to make sure the lease is written properly based on the terms that you've agreed to. And he or she may not really know that level of detail.
Well, you may have agreed to those terms.
Right.
Unknowingly.
Right. Attorneys are still going to raise the question just to make sure. But we as tenant reps need to be reviewing that lease in detail to make sure we're protecting our clients.
Absolutely. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Confessions of a Recovering Landlord podcast, brought to you by our friends over at Riata Commercial Realty, where you can find them at texastenantrep.com or 972-677-0028. Words of wisdom as we sign off.
From me? I think I've given enough.
Okie dokie. Talk to you next time.
Bye.